Good morning, everybody. I hope you had a nice long weekend. Get you all ready for this hearing this morning and for this week. Just a couple of announcements. We will not be holding work sessions on Senate Bill 1061 or on House Bill 2729. I do not intend to move House Bill 3349, although I do want to hear some testimony on one potential amendment on 3349. And Representative Smith, Senator Metzger, you're here. Is it? It's 2258. Is that the right one?
3081.
First one. I'm sorry. Yes, 3081. And why don't you both come forward then, please? Senator Westland, what bill are you here for?
The amendment 3349.
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Ladies first.
Oh, ladies first. Do we wait till he opens? Do you want us to go ahead? Thank
go
you.
Ahead, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Lingo and Chair. Committee, it's really nice of you to hear our bill. House Bill 3081 is brought to you on behalf of Tom and Leslie Newberry, who are here today to testify on what has happened to them. And they've testified in front of our Land Use Committee, our interim land use hearing in Sandy. They've testified at Multnomah County Planning Commission, and we wrote this bill to help them with their situation. I'm going to defer to them to explain to you what has happened to them, but basically what this bill does, and everybody's signed on to it, Multnomah County, LCDC, AOC, Associating Oregon Counties, and it came out of the House on a unanimous committee vote and unanimous House vote. It's a good bill, should pass. Keep it short
before.
And sweet. I'm sure you have.
Senator Ringo, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And again, thank you for hearing this piece of legislation today. You'll hear from the Newberrys, who will give you the details on this. You would never imagine it would be so difficult just to put a foundation under your house. When everybody wants you to do it, and all say they're not able to let you do it. Well, this bill will let them do that, and we appreciate you taking that time. And if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair, we'd like to ask the Newberrys to come forward.
Of course.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Tom Newberry. This is my wife, Leslie. I'm told I should be brief, and I'll try to, but this hasn't been a brief experience. A little over 2 years ago, my wife and I were surprised by the news that we were going to have yet another child that we didn't expect, as the house we lived in, the 100-year-old farmhouse we lived in, was just right at that point. We wanted to add on and make the house safe with a new foundation. When we went to pull the building permit to do that, we were informed that our lot was not a lot of record. To make it short, basically what happened was the land we live on used to be an approximately 20-acre family farm. It was purchased nearly 30 years ago by a nursery company who then split off close to 2 acres where the house was and sold it to someone. This didn't quite meet with the regulations, and the county pointed that out to the gentleman who had done the split. He was told he needed to combine two parcels he owned, the balance of the property that he wasn't selling and another parcel adjacent. He agreed to do that. The county let the land sale go forward, and over the subsequent 20-some years, the property changed hands several times, as did the two parcels that the nurseryman failed to adjoin, or combine, rather. No one caught this for close to 30 years until we decided we needed to make our house safe because it was falling down, the foundation was failing, and we wanted to add on to it. Basically, we've been through every step we can possibly go through of Multnomah County. They'd love to help us. They'd love to give us the foundation permits and other upgrades that you can imagine a 106-year-old house needs. Mm-hmm. But they say their hands are tied, and this has to be fixed at the legislative level, and that's why we're here now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to me to be one of those issues where we need some sort of super appellate board to say this may be what the regulation says, but we want to do what's the right thing for these people with their property. Ma'am, did you want to add?
My husband just basically told the short version of the story. I mean, it's been a 2-year ongoing process. with the county trying to come up with something at the local level, and it's just not happening. They say that it needs to be done at the state level to be fixed.
Okay. And questions from the committee?
From the judge's comment, Chris Crane, who is temporarily with us as committee staff to help work on Measure 37, is also a staff counsel for Multnomah County.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, do you want to add anything about this set of circumstances?
No, the Newberrys gave a very succinct history and definition of what the problem is. They're correct. This is an aspect of a larger problem that sort of begs interim attention, but this will solve the Newberrys problem in the immediate future.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Arch Lachlan.
Good morning, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief also. We've had the opportunity to work with Mr. Crane, representing Multnomah County, LCDC, and Representative Smith to develop the A engrossed 3081. We're supportive of it. We believe it solves a problem and allows an opportunity for them and maybe other people that are found in a similar situation to apply to recognize a parcel that is not legal but today but can be designated so with an application. So we appreciate your hearing this and good bill should pass.
I have already heard that.
Twice now.
Must be true. Thanks very much. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3081. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3081. Are we good with this? Okay.
Let's move it to the floor.
Senator Shields has moved House Bill 3081 to the Senate floor with a D-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. And thanks very much for coming in. I hope this takes care of you. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3349, Senator Westland.
You claim you already
talked to us about this bill.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, here to testify not only in behalf of 3349, but to offer a friendly amendment. This deals with veterans, and despite the fact that there is an exploding population of veterans in Central Oregon, and in particular homeless veterans, there is at this present time no shelter or outreach program east of the Cascades. And as I think we can all agree, now is absolutely not the time to let our veterans' needs go unmet. To address this problem, Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, a local nonprofit, wants to launch a veteran shelter and outreach program in an abandoned, keyword, existing fire station located a quarter of a mile outside of Bend's EGB. The fire station is perfect for this use. It contains sleeping quarters, shower facilities, cooking facilities, office space, and has close access to the VA outpatient medical clinic. The service center will be staffed with other area veterans, and transitional supports will be available, including shelter, food, counseling, rehabilitation, and training to help these homeless vets return to our society. Once the local group raises 35% of the funds needed and has a building available, i.e. the building we are discussing, HUD will provide the other 65% of the funding. But the fire station is located in an EFU zone, and although we allow community centers in said zone, unfortunately, for the purposes of this discussion, current land use law does not define community centers in a manner that allows services to be provided to veterans. Mr. Chair, committee, this amendment would extend the definition of community centers within half a mile of city boundaries to include existing buildings that would allow services provided to vets. We have spoken with the sponsor of this bill. They have worked closely with us in crafting this amendment, and they have no objections. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Westland, you're referring to the Dash 6 amendments.
Well, we've had several iterations, and if I could look to my cohort on this, we'll just get him up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. There are two, the Dash 6 and the Dash 7s, and the Dash 7s are, in fact, a gut and stuff, Senator Ryer. Senator Westland described what the Dash 6s do. The Dash 7s also do the same thing. But in addition to the Dash 7s, they take the language regarding the farm use assessment in EFU zones, and they put it in the revenue section where it belongs instead of in the land use section. So we definitely recommend the Dash 7 amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You want the gut and stuff?
No.
Who are you talking to? Senator Westman?
Someone, I guess. Don just said he wants the Dash 7 amendments, which are the gut and stuff, not just the addition.
If I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, the Dash 7s take the language, remove the language on farm use assessment from the land use section in 215, 283, and instead put it in 308A, where it should have been in the first place. So it is a gut and stuff in that regard, and it does include Senator Westland's amendments also.
And for the record, the amender has talked with the amendee, and the amendments, I think, need both our satisfaction. The sevens.
Okay. Well, we won't be moving on right now, but... Thank you. Other questions from the committee?
Well, I'm kind of curious why it is, I'm lost now, apparently, though, why it is Don wants to gut and stuff his own bill.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, representing Farm Bureau, again, Senator Beyer, the language regarding the farmer's assessment was incorrectly placed in the wrong part of the law. It should have been in the revenue section of the law, and that's what the Dash 7s do. The original bill had it in the land use planning section of the law, and this deals with automatic farm use assessment, whether or not a zone qualifies for automatic farm use assessment or not. And that should be in the revenue section, and so we've redrafted it so that it does appear in the revenue section. And that's what the Dash 7s do, along with Senator Westland's good amendments.
But in the House, it was okay?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in the House, it went through the House the other way, and the other way would work. It's just not the most appropriate way to do it. So we figure, as long as we're making amendments, let's make it correct. And that's what we've done with the Dash 7s.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate your testimony, both of you. Anything else to add, Senator Westland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. There's some potential amendments also to this bill, and I'd like the amendments aren't prepared, but I'd like some very brief discussion of those from Matt Minahan, Laura Borders, and Bill, was it Zuber?
Laura and Bill couldn't make it this morning.
Okay.
They're a little stuck in traffic, I believe.
All right. So you want us to add something else to 3349. Why don't you tell us what it is?
The Dash 1 amendments, and they should already be drawn up, actually.
For the record, your name is?
Matt Minahan, lobbyist for OPA, Oregon Pyrotechnics Association.
Okay.
Basically, the Dash 1 amendments deal with fireworks and allow fireworks to be stored where currently high explosives are being stored. I came to speak for the Dash 1 amendments proposed for 3349. That's before you today. The amendment is a remedy to inconsistencies in the current ORS that deal with the storage of fireworks. In short, this bill allows federally licensed pyrotechnicians to store fireworks in state-approved magazines. And I also point out there's other provisions set out by the county in terms of where they can store them, 50 feet away from a stream. From barricaded buildings. Basically, these are licensed pyrotechnicians that can store high explosives to blow up stumps for farmers. They make cannons to scare away birds. They just can't, and they can legally manufacture fireworks, they just can't store them currently where they're storing high explosives, so this amendment allows them to do that. Main point I'd like to make is there won't be an influx of storage units on farmland. The storage units, many of them are already currently in place. Again, they're in place and they're storing high explosives. They just can't store fireworks. And so this would clean that up and allow them to do that.
Questions from the committee? Who's going to oppose this bill?
That's a good question. I have received some resistance on the House side. A certain representative made it clear to me that he didn't like the bill.
Is that to protect one establishment?
Well, I'll kind of give you some history on the bill. There is the Senate Bill 667 did pass the House last session, and the way it was worded, it kind of remedied this issue, but the way it was worded, it only dealt with one business. It was worded saying if you were in continuous operation since 1986 and had a state-approved manufacturing license, which you can't get anymore. So basically the issue was remedied, but unfortunately the way it was written, it only applied to one business. And we would like to open it up and have it apply to everybody else. And there certainly has been some resistance from that organization.
Okay. All right. Well, we will, as I said, we're not passing the bill today, but we'll give a chance for the committee to sit on that for a little while.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Closes the public hearing on House Bill 3349. Yeah. Representative Greenleaf, we're going to go to one other bill and then we'll come to this one. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 3461. Dave Nelson, Brent Searle, Mike Hayes, Eric Bowen.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Nelson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council. Grass seed is grown on about 500,000 acres in the state of Oregon and is sold around the United States and to over 60 countries around the world. House Bill 3461 adds two species, annual ryegrass and tall fescue, to the Oregon Department of Agriculture program, facilitating negotiations between seed growers and seed dealers over prices of grass seed. The legislation is permissive and does not mandate any specific action on the part of any of the parties. If annual ryegrass growers and tall fescue growers intend to implement their rights under or their authorities under House Bill 3461, they generally must form a cooperative to come into compliance with the Capra-Volstead Act passed by the federal government in the late 1920s. The original bill, House Bill 3811, was passed by the legislature in 2001. And it provided a mechanism for growers and dealers, and really provided a mechanism for dealers to meet in the same room and to discuss prices without falling in violation of restraint of trade laws under the federal restraint of trade statutes. The bill was written by a combination of attorneys for the growers, attorneys for the dealers that arose out of a lawsuit in the late 1990s by a federal judge who was presiding over the case and by the Oregon Attorney General. House Bill, I've attached the vote that created the process to my testimony. You can see that it passed under the consent calendar in the House of Representatives and passed the Senate 27-1. Senator Hammond was the only one voting no in 2001, and Representative Whip was the only one voting no on the House side. So it was a pretty well worked out, non-contentious bill at that time, and these amendments simply add these two species of grass seed to that process, and I know of no opposition to those inclusions. With me is Mr. Brent Searle with the Department of Agriculture, and also Mike Hayes on my far right, who is the Vice President of the Oregon Seed Council, and Eric Bowers, a tall fescue seed grower from Harrisburg, who is a past president of the Oregon Seed Council. But Brent?
Chair, members of the
committee, for the record, Brent Searle with Oregon Department of Agriculture. I've distributed some testimony there, and rather than go through it, unless you have some technical questions about the process, I think I'll defer to the growers here and their interest in this process. I'd be glad to go into detail, if you'd like, on how we administer this process. Basically, it's a voluntary negotiation process which the state supervises. So.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Mike Hayes with the Oregon Seed Council. Also, I'm a grower in the Albany-Lebanon area. For the past several years, we've watched the Perennial Ryegrass Bargaining Association operate in the state of Oregon. And we've seen the benefits to the growers, and we feel that this is some legislation that would be very beneficial to the annual ryegrass and tall fescue growers in the state of Oregon. So we're really pleased that this bill is being presented to you today.
Well, thank you for coming to testify today.
Everything Mike said, I kind of ditto, Senators and Mr. Chairman.
And your name is?
Eric Bowers. Hi, Eric. Annual ryegrass grower and tall fescue grower from Linn County down by Harrisburg. And I think this would help stabilize our market if we could get included in this legislation with perennial ryegrass. Right now, the way our markets have been working here lately, it's not really a market. We don't have the speculators like we used to that would kind of give us a market year-round and run it up and down, and you could kind of participate. It's kind of like when they need it, they call us, and when they don't need it, the phone never rings. And so the price goes down artificially. And we're just trying to stabilize the price where we can make a living. And so I guess if you guys would pass this out of here, that'd be great. Thank you.
Well, we'd like to help you guys stay in business and make a living. That's certainly our goal. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming to Salem. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3461. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3461.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3461 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 3461 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Can you carry it?
Yeah, Senator Beyer, if you would carry that would be great. Thank you very much. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 527. And Senator Morissette, Senator Whitsitt, and Ms. Whitsitt, do you want to? I don't really want to have a full hearing on this, but I guess I'd like just a little bit of introduction of where we are on the amendments, and if one of you or all of you would like to come up and explain that would be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Members.
Go ahead.
I think you probably have the Dash 6 amendments before you. They're pretty self-explanatory. The primary purpose for this bill, as you know, the legislature was misinformed some years ago about a manufactured energy crisis, and as a result of that, they created a virtual dictatorial powers for the Energy Facility Siting Council. And this bill is designed to redirect some of that siting authority back to elected officials where it belongs, while maintaining EFSEC's functional power to site needed energy facilities. This bill I think one of the primary drivers here, if you look at Section 14, Sub 3, it says that Any certificate signed by the chairperson of the council shall bind the state and all counties and cities and political subdivisions in this state as to the approval of the site and the construction and operation of the facility. Any affected state agency, county, city, and political subdivision shall, upon submission by the applicant of the proper applications and payment of the proper fees, but without hearing or other proceeding, promptly issue the permits, licenses, and certificates as addressed in the site certificate, subject only to conditions set forth in the site certificate. It just basically gives them the power to decide for the public and for the elected officials what will be done, and then see to it that it is done. The purpose of this bill is to, as I said, to redirect that authority back.
The question I have is that on page 4 of the bill, it mentions if the council and the affected local government are unable to resolve the issues, the party shall have the issues resolved by binding arbitration. How would that work? What standards would the arbitrator apply?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. The standards that are applied are according to the American Arbitration Society. These are professional arbitrators who arbitrate a number of disputes. Included in that arbitration, not specifically spelled out, fact-finding, an opportunity for mediation, and then finally the arbitrator would make the decision. Senator Whitsitt did not mention the fact that we did attend a Supreme Court case 2 weeks ago that cost upwards of $200,000 in 2 years over this very issue in Klamath County, and it should not take that much money and that long to resolve a local dispute. There's something wrong with the statute as it is written. It precludes an individual or a jurisdiction from any meaningful dialogue about the siting of a facility.
Would the arbitrator say that the energy facility can move forward if it meets the statewide planning goals? What findings would the arbitrator make that would let that arbitrator decide whether the siting should go forward or not?
Well, the findings would be presented by each side. Obviously, the side that has standing, which would be a local jurisdiction, would come in and cite land use restrictions, including seismic, including water rights, including farmland, including other statutory restrictions and land use, and the siting council would then present their case that they have the right under the statute basically to ignore all of these. And at some point, the arbitrator would make a decision based on the presentation of both sides. Now,
based on what legal standard, though?
Well, based on the land use standards of the state of Oregon, as opposed to the authority of the siting council to overlook the land use standards. And so that would be the arbitrator's task, would be to come to a decision taking into account the fact that the existing statute does give the siting council to site a facility. The only thing that the siting council must, that only restriction is the air quality, and that's a federal standard. Other than that, there are no restrictions. Water rights. So the arbitrator would make a decision based on the presentation of existing statute versus the existing land use laws of the state of Oregon.
Okay. Do you want to add something?
Thank you very much, Chair Ringo and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Arkin from Eugene, Oregon. And maybe part of the answer to your question could be found on page 3 of the dash. I'm looking at dash 6, line 12B, where it talks about compliance with statewide land use planning goals and how exceptions may be taken to those goals. but only after significant environmental, economic, social, and energy consequences anticipated as a result of the facility are identified and the adverse effects of the facility are mitigated in accordance with the rules of the council. So I think that when both sides would present their case to binding arbitration, they would have to make a case as to whether they have mitigated any adverse consequences or not, and then that would be for the arbitrators to weigh the evidence.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions for the Senator Shields? I'm sorry. Senator Shields, go ahead.
I guess this is for anybody. As all too often is the case, there's only three of us here this morning. I like your bill, but have you talked to the other members of the committee that aren't here?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've spoken to both members of the committee who are not here, yes.
Getting a favorable response?
They are favorable, yes, okay. They are.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what social and energy consequences are?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Can you tell me what is meant by social and energy consequences?
Social and energy consequences.
Yeah, so one of the things in this sub B that was just read to us was in compliance with statewide planning goals may be achieved by taking an exception to the applicable goal, but only after the significant environmental, economic. I know what environmental means. I know what economic means. But what are social and energy consequences?
Well, I'll answer that. I'll try to answer it. I think that the social consequences would deal with the inhabitants of the surrounding area. I know on the Coburg proposed plant, the application has been withdrawn in that particular plant, but the residents were very concerned about the quality of life that would exist in the area, particularly along the Coburg Hills, that where the prevailing winds usually blows the pollution and it just kind of sits there. Now, a gas-fired plant would emit some undesirable pollution that would back up against the Coburg Hills, and that was felt to be a social quality of life issue. Energy requirements or energy refers to whether or not we really need a power plant, and based on the a study done concerning need, I think that which would be part of the presentation to the binding arbitrator, that would cover whether or not there was a need for a plant at this particular time, what kind of plant it was, and where it might be. But energy need, I think, was at the top of the list of concerns several years ago during the energy crisis. Since then, there has been a reevaluation of energy need and the type of plant that we need to produce the power. So I think both of those would be covered by social and energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Whitson?
In addressing that question also, within the Supreme Court hearing recently, there were three issues: primary land use, seismic hazard, and water rights. The land use issue was certainly directed to that social indication that you had, Senator, in that the people in Lancho Valley had certain investment-backed expectations when they purchased the property, and that was that there were land use laws that would prevent a large industrial site from being pumped down in the middle of the valley. That's part of that social issue, and that's one of the things that's being argued in the Supreme, was argued in the Supreme Court, and is currently being addressed by the justices. The seismic hazard part of it refers to public safety, in that the FSEC Council chose to not characterize the site prior to issuing a site certificate, and this particular plant would be sitting right on the strike of a vertical fault that has a displacement of about 2,200 feet. It seems like a strange place to site one of the largest energy facilities in the United States. On the water right issue, once again, this comes back to a social issue from a standpoint, social and legal, in that they were creating a water right for the applicant that by creating conditions that mitigated the law provided them with a water right in a priority inappropriate because there were at least 30 other applicants that have drought permits in wells in that area. They simply mitigated the law by writing conditions and issued and forced the Oregon Water Resources Department to issue that certificate. So within those parameters, I think that the other thing is on these energy, this particular energy plant is certainly a merchant plant. There is no local need for that energy, and it has not been demonstrated regional need at this time for that energy. So that's how I would address your question, sir.
Do you know where the Department of Energy is on this? Have they changed their position from the earlier hearing?
To my knowledge, they have not signed on to this bill.
Mr. Chair, go ahead, Senator Bauer. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, I appreciate your explanation, but it seems to me like when you're talking about land use laws, that's more environmental and economic. When we're talking about water, that's economic clearly, and it seems like the fault issue, the geography issue is clearly environmental. The social being there is a completely subjective thing, in my opinion. I don't know how you're going to get to measuring a quality of life when you're talking about siting the facility, because someone will always object to everything, and it's going to alter someone's quality of life no matter where you put anything. And I don't care if it's a power plant. I don't care what you're talking about. It can be a cattle ranch. It can be anything, but someone is going to alter someone's quality of life. So when you bring in the word social, as clearly, I think it's probably undefined as to what it is. I think we've built a record here as to what social is, and it becomes more concerning to me when you bring that in, because now everything under the sun as to legislative record is now a social issue.
Maybe that's why the bill has created a mandatory arbitration process to let an administrative law judge decide from the standpoint of the siting certificate whether these arguments are appropriate or not. It still leaves open that ability of the public that was exercised by the people of Climas to ask review by the Supreme Court, which they did, and this would still be available to the public to do that. But from the standpoint of determining the social and energy and all other sort of things, that's what the arbitration is for.
And just to follow up, I mean that's why I was asking the questions about what standards the arbitrator shall apply, and I think unless somehow we specify what those standards are, the arbitrators, they're not going to know what to do. This is what I want to do. I think we need to just let this bill sit for a couple more days and let the committee members get more comfortable with it. And so I'm going to close the work session. We'll roll it over till Thursday. And I would be happy to have a meeting with the two of you and try to understand some of these issues in a little bit more detail. Senator Morissette.
Yeah. thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the one thing that I want to emphasize in this is the fact that it took $200,000 in 2 years for a group of citizens who had standing to take a case to the Supreme Court. And I think that is unacceptable. If that's the only recourse that people have, to go to the State of Oregon Supreme Court. And what we're proposing is an arbitration that is a much more, well, a simpler process, less costly, and I'm sure would bring fair results. So I just wanted to restate that.
This is what I need to understand. I need to understand what standards the arbitrator shall make his or her decision.
Good.
I mean, you just can't tell an arbitrator do the right thing, do the fair thing. You have to have legal standards to apply.
Well, now I'm confused because I thought Senator Wittsitt just said the Supreme Court would still be available after arbitration.
They would be.
So if you don't agree with the arbitration, you're still going to have that $200,000 until you...
The first day in court available under current law is at the Supreme Court. This arbitration would allow a simpler court proceeding to occur and allow people to have their day in court and understand that this is, you know, have their concerns adjudicated. You could still, as in almost any legal proceeding, you can appeal that. And you could appeal that again to the Supreme Court. But if you had your day in court without having to spend that, and as Senator Morissette said, a couple hundred thousand dollars, what Senator Morissette did not say is that the land use lawyer who has been representing these people did about half of that pro bono. I mean, it's really, really expensive. And it's... And Senator Morissette's point is well taken in that there should be a less expensive way to have your day in court and to have your concerns adjudicated than to go to the Supreme Court. And I understand the purpose of going to the Supreme Court was to fast track it. There would only be one decision. But that was created at a time when the legislature believed that we were in an energy crisis that never existed.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session for today. Let's roll over till Thursday. I need to get some of this more settled in my mind, and maybe Senator Byer does too, and maybe by then Senator Atkinson and Senator Burdick will be here, and so we'll see what happens on Thursday. But I
thank you very much. Thank you very much for having us.
Let's close the work session on what is that? On Senate Bill 527. I want to open a work session on Senate Bill 699. Marshall Kobe, do you want to let us know where the amendments stand on 699? Ralph?
Marshall's with me. Mr. Chair, committee members, Ralph Sapper, senior Boise Cascade. Your question was, where are the amendments?
Well, we had a discussion on this bill quite a while ago.
Right.
Essentially, you would like us to adopt the -1 amendments, am I correct?
Well, our bill, we thought that was fine. That had a broader range. The -1s just apply to Jackson County.
I'm sorry, what?
The -1s just apply to Jackson County.
They narrowed.
They narrowed. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and we're fine with that.
Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Marshall, anything to add?
No, sir.
All right. Well, we're in the work session, and I appreciate a motion on the -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 699.
Senator Byers moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 699. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 699 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 699 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3310. Linda Ludwig, Rob Halliburton, John Chandler. They all duck out just now.
Caught them off guard.
Mr. Chandler, good morning.
Good morning.
How was your weekend? Go ahead. Who wants to start here?
Aye. Chair Engel, members of the committee, I'm Rob Halliburton from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Actually, I was hoping Linda Ludwig would start since she's carrying this bill.
Okay.
This bill relates to periodic review of land use regulations of local comprehensive land use plans. It's the outgrowth of an interim committee's work, of which John Chandler here was a member, as was Linda, who's, I guess, going to get here. And Linda also has copies of the report from that committee with the recommendations. We've delivered the report to Chair Ringo, but Linda has copies for the rest of the committee. And the committee had comprised six recommendations, of which 3310 incorporates. It made it through the House, and we did find a few drafting errors that we wanted to fix, which is why we had some dash amendments from what came out of the House. The department has supported the bill. It's an outgrowth of the fact that periodic review has been a little more than we thought it. It's been more than we could chew for both state and local jurisdictions over the years. It's a process that has taken quite a few resources from both the Department of Land Conservation and Development as well as from cities and counties to get through the process. It's been tweaked several times over the years to try to make it more of a process that can be achieved in a more efficient and timely manner. And this is another effort along those lines to try to focus and define the process a little better. You're pointing, is there Linda?
I'm pointing at Linda Ludwig.
So that she can come rescue me from my stumbling here?
Oh, that's okay. Why don't you continue? Linda will arrive in a second.
Okay, with the copies of the report, I hope, yes.
Okay.
And so 3310, again, to pick up, focuses and refines periodic review a little more. It would be a process that fewer jurisdictions would now be required to complete, and it further refines those issues that they would need to complete periodic review on. There's five topics: economic development, housing, public facilities and services, transportation, and urbanization. It would apply primarily to cities only. The rural plans would not be required to go through the periodic review process. This doesn't mean that local jurisdictions wouldn't be required to keep their plans up to date. It just wouldn't be on a schedule through a mandated process that we've come to call periodic review.
Okay. Linda, why don't you let us know what we need to know in addition to that.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I stepped out of the room for a minute and you called it back.
Sorry about that. First of all, you want us to adopt the Dash 5 amendments?
The Dash 5 are some housekeeping amendments to HB 3310A.
All right.
Yes, they are. I don't know how in deep Mr. Halliburton went into the report and the history of the periodic review cleanup, but this is basically phase two of looking at periodic review, trying to make it more efficient, more effective. Last session, Senate Bill 920 was passed. 920 was passed as a result of a lot of periodic reviews. We think about 350 in what we called the bulge in the snake. They were hung up in the process, and it wasn't a very helpful thing for local governments or the department to have them in limbo, as it were. So Senate Bill 920 did a couple of things. It streamlined the process in terms of putting a hold on new periodic reviews coming in, new work programs coming online, and it put forward an interim work task, a work committee, to look at, from a statewide perspective and also a local perspective, what are the problems and what are the benefits of the periodic review program, and make some recommendations to this legislative session. The report is fairly definitive, and there are five major changes, I would think, the bullets here, that are included in the executive summary, which is on page 3 of the periodic review report, and if you'd like, I'd hit those in plain language real quickly.
Sure.
The recommendations, the bill permanently reduced the number of cities required to undergo a mandatory periodic review by exempting cities with a population less than 10,000 or differently if they are in an MPO, unless there are significant changes such as a major state investment or a major new employer.
And what page of the report are you on?
I'm on the executive summary.
Okay, I got you.
That's
okay.
Page 3. That's number 1. It reduces the number and frequency of local governments.
Thank you.
Required to do capacity reviews.
Lowercase Roman 2.
I think it's in the executive summary view. II, isn't it?
Yes, II. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
That is consistent with the number that was put in Senate Bill 920. The second one is it provides an opportunity for voluntary review for exempt cities and counties. So they have an option to undergo a voluntary simplified periodic review process. There in number 4, the bill decouples the periodic review process as the required time frame for cities and counties to amend comprehensive plans and land use regulations to comply with any new statutory goal or rule requirements. Those new requirements will be implemented by a post-acknowledgement plan amendment process, or a PAPA now. Item there, number 5. The bill allows no appeal of a decision to adopt a periodic review work program. Current law provides for an appeal both of the adoption of the work program and the completion of the work program task by any participant. And the appeal of the adoption of the program before any a work is actually accomplished has burdened the periodic review process with little benefit. And lastly, it makes LCDC the single forum, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, of review for matters arising in periodic review. Generally, LCDC, rather than LUBA, has had jurisdiction over periodic review decisions by local governments. However, oftentimes, attorneys for citizens objecting to a local review decision often feel compelled, due to malpractice concerns, to double file or file an appeal both at LCDC and LUBA. And local governments must defend both those decisions in both places. It is wasteful and expensive of LUBA's time, local government's time, and certainly of our objectors' time as well. So those are the major bullet points of the report, and that what you see in HP 3310. Again, the dash A5 amendments are just cleaning up this piece of legislation, which took some time to get it in the right language, as you can see, boiling the report down into language that we all could agree was correct. The next page, you'll see who participated in that work group, and I think you'd agree that it was a great cross-section of whom we have involved in the state and land use planning. I think, unless you have some questions.
Okay. Time?
I'm done.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. 3310 is a product of one of those rare beasts around this process, a work group that actually did what the legislature said it should do. We met probably at least once a month during the interim, long 2-3-4-hour blocks. Everybody that should have been at the table was. We had open meetings. It was chaired by John Van Lanningham, who was also the chair of LCDC. Citizens participated through sitting in on some of these meetings. Those citizens who apparently didn't have anything better to do with 3 or 4 hour blocks of their time than listen to discussions of periodic review. And what's in front of you is a consensus draft with a couple of exceptions. There was a minority report, which you'll see in that report. And the minority report, frankly, is high-centered on the same point that we've high-centered on, and some of you may recall these conversations in previous sessions. When you have 240-some-odd cities or 30-some-odd cities of varying sizes, how do you address the need for Portland and Culver, to use my old hometown, to go through the same process? The tools are different, the skills are different, the sophistication levels are different, the needs are different. in 3310, we've decided to say the larger jurisdictions, with some call-outs in terms of growth rate and whatnot, should be required to keep their plans up to speed. Here's the process. The smaller jurisdictions where there's not that much going on economically or population growth should have a process to opt in but not be required. Outside of that little argument, what's in front of you is a consensus product. It was a good piece of work, if I do say so as a member of the group. I've been involved in a lot of these task forces over the years. This is probably one of the best in terms of actually grappling with the issues, arguing things through, making sure that what was presented was presented right. The Dash 5 amendments are a result of that process continuing when some of these technical difficulties became apparent when the bill got drafted. We've communicated by email exhaustively over some thoughts. We've had some in-person meetings trying to bring the closure and clarity to the amendments in front of you. I commend it to you with the Dash 5 amendments. But if I might, Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out for the record that I do not commend the Dash 4 amendments, which are on the table.
We'll talk about those in a minute. Okay. Anything else? Any questions for the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead.
Chair Ingo, if I may, I'm anticipating a potential question. Section 10 of the bill deals with what Linda described regarding unifying appeals with LCDC, and I wanted to mention that there is Senate Bill 431, is it, that does the same thing, and we're replicating the language here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. You've stunned us with your good work and your wisdom on this. Art Schlack, additional comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. We, too, were a member of the work group on periodic review, and I just want to indicate for the record, Mr. Chair, that the Association of Oregon Counties is supportive of passage of 3081 with the Dash 5 amendments.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Bach.
Sir, I'm trying to find out, and I'm finally found the minority report, and it says three members disagree with the committee recommendations, but it doesn't say which three members. Can we answer that question?
Or did Linda, do you want to come back and answer that? This question was which members disagreed in the majority opinion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the issue really was in terms of disagreements, and I think the minority report covers it well, whether or not we have a system that has all cities doing periodic review at some point.
I understand that. I'm wondering which three members of the committee issued the minority report.
The minority report was issued in majority by Ed Sullivan, and Sid Freeman also concurred with some of the concerns that Ed had, as well as Becky Stackler.
Thank you.
And again, that was about the frequency of periodic review for small cities, primarily. Which I will say none of us disagreed with. It's just a question of resources, both from the state and local resources.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm sorry, it was Ed Sullivan and Sid Friedman who did the minority report, and who was the third person?
I believe it was Becky Stickler on that issue. It was Mr. Sullivan that actually wrote the minority report.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. And just to the committee, on the table, and I believe in your packets, there's the Dash 4 amendments that Mr. Chandler referenced. The Dash 4 amendments reference the siting of big box retail stores and what public process may be allowed in connection with the siting of those, and I just want to make sure that those are referenced, and we will be looking at this bill again on Thursday. So thanks very much, and let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3310. Good morning, Senator Atkinson. How was your weekend?
No, obviously.
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2875. Jerry Bryan, Christina McNitt.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which is a trade association primarily of irrigation districts and water control districts and other organizations that deliver water. Close to half of all water rights in the state of Oregon are delivered through districts. House Bill 2875 was drafted at our request, and due to an incident during this last interim, excuse me, let me interrupt myself and introduce Jerry Bryan. He's a district manager from Farmers Irrigation District. When I originally wrote this testimony, I wasn't fortunate enough to have him join me here. So he is here today, although it's not indicated on my testimony. Mount Hood experienced several small earthquakes, and while by earthquake standards they were small, they were pretty devastating to Farmers Irrigation District. The quakes collapsed a district flume, causing an immediate need to relocate the district's irrigation diversion in order to continue to deliver water to the farmers in the district. The district, the Water Resources Department, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife all worked together to resolve the crisis, although since then we've concluded that the statute doesn't precisely provide, it's silent about providing the ability to do so, to make an emergency temporary change in point of diversion. House Bill 2875 would add this ability for a district with a manager to change the point of diversion in the event of an emergency that prevents the district from diverting water from its authorized point of diversion. As with all other provisions in ORS Chapter 540, which is the district transfer statutes, the transfers are limited to one irrigation season, may not result in injury to any existing water right, and in fact, the department may condition, reject, or revoke any temporary transfer at any time to the extent necessary to avoid injury if the department finds that the transfer is causing injury to an existing water right. Under district transfer statutes in Chapter 540, 570 sub 2 currently provides that a district with a manager may temporarily change the point of diversion or appropriation combined with a change in place of use, a change in point of diversion, or change a primary right to a supplemental right under several conditions. And those conditions are that the land receiving the water is within the district boundaries, that other terms of the permit or certificate remain the same, including the beneficial use and the total number of acres to which the water is applied, and the diversion is provided with a proper fish screen if required by OWRD. So I'd like to have Mr. Bryan address the committee kind of about what happened at Farmers Irrigation District, how he reached out to Water Resources Department, ODF&W, and how ultimately they changed the point of diversion and got the water to the farmers in the district.
Chair Ringo and members of the committee, I'm Jerry Bryan, Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River, Oregon. Christina's already done a pretty good job of covering the basics of the story, so I'll be brief. But last summer, a small earthquake by earthquake standards with an epicenter very close to our major conveyance flume for 3,000 acres of high-value orchard land in Hood River. The earthquake bumped the flume sufficiently that the flume was destroyed. It was right at peak season, peak irrigation demand, and right at a time when if we had not been able to reestablish diversion and water to those farmers, the crops would have been lost. So we did what we do in that basin. We contacted the Oregon Water Resources Department, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We also work with the other natural resource agencies in the basin and started looking at what opportunities we had to restore flow to the growers within, we hope, 3 days. It actually took us about 5 days. We were surprised when we talked with the Oregon Water Resources Department to learn that there was no specific provision allowing for an emergency change of point of diversion.
The first thing the Oregon Water Resources Department asked us is whether or not we were in communication with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which we were. And the Fish and Wildlife folks had already stepped up assisting with fish screening requirements and those things that pertain to properly operated diversions in the waters of the state of Oregon. So we were able to get the water flowing. We were able to save the crops in Hood River, but we did, through the process, identify an issue, a lack in statute to allow us to do this in a systematic and quick way. So thank you. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, how far did you move the actual point of diversion to resolve the emergency?
We moved the diversion. The entire canal is approximately 6 miles long. We moved the diversion approximately 2.5 miles downstream, which allowed us to restore flow and, in the course of the summer, replace the flume so that we could reestablish service.
Follow up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you have to build a lot of extra canal, or how did you do this? I mean, or did it all, was there a quick, easy connection?
It was not quick and easy. We managed to do it quickly. It wasn't particularly easy. We had to, there's quite a bit of fall along the canal. The river drops away pretty quickly. So we actually had to fly in full-size, industrial-size pumps from New Jersey in order to establish the diversion. Fortunately, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife worked with us to put together a screen, which we were able to attach to the end of the pipes and then start it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adam Sussman, Doug Myers.
Okay, go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. House Bill 2875 would allow irrigation districts to temporarily change their point of diversion for one irrigation system. And under current law, temporary district transfers are only required to have fish screens if required by the Water Resources Department, and I refer you to page 1, lines 27 and 28. Changes in the point of diversion, whether temporary or permanent, have potential to harm fish if they lack adequate screening and bypass devices or create barriers to fish passage. ODFMW, as the manager of the state's fisheries, is the most qualified agency to make the decision as to whether these devices are necessary to protect Oregon's valuable fishery. Water Watch opposes the bill unless it is amended to require that temporary transfers are conditioned to require fish screens and bypass devices and fish passage, as may be required by ODFMW. And please see attachment one with a sort of a marked up suggested version of this. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What? Are the proponents of the bill going to say that because of the emergency situation, it's just not practical to condition this based on to create more hurdles for this? Isn't that what they're going to say?
I suspect that's what they're going to say, Mr. Chairman.
Why wouldn't that be a good argument?
Because fish passage and bypass and screens are important. And what we're saying is that they should, that ODFMW should be the one to make that determination and decision and not just be consulted. We're asking that bypass and fish passage should be added to the fish screen thing, and that ODFMW should make the call, not Water Resources.
Okay. Senator Shields?
Doug, specifically in Hood River, what would the consequence have been if this had been in place?
Well, I Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I suspect that since it took 5 days, and since ODFMW was right there apparently making the calls, that they would be fine under the bill as we suggest that we amend it.
Okay. Adam.
Good morning, and members of the committee. My name is Adam Sussman. I'm with the Water Resources Department. I want to just start out by saying that the department does support House Bill 2875 as drafted, and I'll sort of break the comment down into two different pieces. The first piece was about Water Resources Department deciding whether or not fish screening should be required, and there are many places in the statute and in our rules where the department essentially consults with ODFW. We don't make the decision on our own whether to require fish screens or not, because we don't have that sort of expertise. And in fact, in our rules, it talks about how the department shall consult with ODFW to determine whether diversion should be equipped with an appropriate fish screen. And if that's the case, then we put that in the order approving the transfer. The second part having to do with fish passage, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has separate authority to require fish passage if they believe it to be necessary in any one of these transactions. And as you heard in the case in Hood River, the department notifies the Department of Fish and Wildlife right away when we get these kinds of transactions, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife then begins to work on the ground with the applicant to decide and to design if fish passage is needed and how that should be implemented. When we testified on this bill on the House, the Department of Fish and Wildlife came to the table with the Water Resources Department and said they were comfortable with the bill and didn't believe that it was necessary to describe that separate authority in this bill for a temporary transfer.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Is there anybody from ODFW here? Do you want to weigh in on this? No? Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Russ Stoff. I'm working as a legislative liaison for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for this session. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife supports House Bill 2875 as currently drafted. We believe that Mr. Sussman's testimony fairly characterized our relationship in requiring both screening and passage.
Okay. Senator Shields.
So, just to push a little farther, what would Doug's amendment do in a practical sense, and what concerns do you have about that?
Senator Ringo and Senator Shields, one thing aside from the resource issues that I'll let them cover is that it would set up a very strange result in the statute, in that for a temporary emergency point of diversion change, you'd have a requirement, some sort of requirement in the statute regarding fish passage, but you wouldn't have that requirement in the statute for a regular long-term water right transfer. So I just wanted to sort of point that out, that it sets up a very awkward dichotomy in the statute, for one.
Okay. Well, I just want to think about this a little bit. I guess, Doug, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about this after the hearing. So let's close this work session, and I expect to move the bill out on Thursday, but we'll just go ahead and close it right now. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2875. And I'd like to open we have a work session scheduled on House Bill 3313. Kathleen Warman, are you here? Would you like to come up and just give us a summary of this? Yeah, this is House Bill 3313.
Hi. Hello, I'm Kathleen Warman.
Good morning.
Would you like me to tell you what this bill does?
Sure.
Okay. And this clarifies the existing template test law and an issue where the existing law is silent. What this law would do is include a dwelling on the template boundary line in the count of dwellings needed, required to meet the template test.
Okay.
So if you have the template boundary line cutting a house in half, you get to count that house.
Okay. And we know of no opposition to this, correct?
We know that Multnomah County is aware of this bill and has not expressed any opposition to it.
Okay.
And
Crane, do you have any wisdom on this bill?
not except to say Ms. Warman has been ably represented throughout all of the proceedings on this bill.
Also, that this did go through the House Land Use Committee unanimously, and it was voted on unanimously on the House floor.
Okay, thank you, and we're in work session. Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 3313 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Thank you very much. I would be happy to carry that. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yes.
As a point of clarification, when we heard the bill last week, you were concerned about the change in the order.
Oh, that's right.
Did you get? I mean, could you enlighten us why
that? I was looking through that again last night. I did not. I decided that it was probably a technical issue.
Chris, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, correct. I just looked at that. I believe it's a distinction without a difference. The land use regulations have to be consistent with the comprehensive plan. So if something is inconsistent with one, it would necessarily be inconsistent with the other. So the conjunction there should be and instead of or.
All right. I want to open a work session on Senate Bill 1032. We've got some amendments. Who's here and wants to explain the amendments? Mr. Conkling? Randy, do you want to come up as well? He shrugs his shoulders and says, maybe. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling, here representing the Beaverton School District, along with Randy Tucker representing Metro. As you recall from our hearing on this bill, Beaverton, along with some other high-growth school districts, have been forced to look outside the urban growth boundary for school sites. It's not an easy thing to do, nor something that school districts approach lightly. What we have attempted to do is to try to find a way in the Portland metropolitan area to work with our urban service providers as well as with Metro, which makes a decision about urban growth boundary expansion, to make sure that we have a process that makes as much sense as it can in that we are in our particular case in Beaverton, looking for school sites to serve existing populations inside the urban growth boundary. The amendment that has been developed, which Randy can also speak to as well, really has two key components. First off, it is limited to the metropolitan area and Metro, as well as to high-growth school districts with respect to the key provision that I'll talk about in just a moment. But the two principal things that it does is that it allows a school district, a high-growth school district, to work and collaborate with Metro in where outside the urban growth boundary to look for a potential school site or sites. And second of all, it provides that Metro will have a process that can work in between its periodic review and provide for an accelerated process to bring these school sites inside the UGB when they're ready to come.
Okay. Thank you. Randy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. The only thing I would add to that is that in discussion with our attorney who helped draft these amendments, and the amendments look faithful to what we submitted to LC, is that if you see, I think on line 16 on page 2, where it mentions a high-growth school district, we would probably design that process to for any school district in the Metropolitan Service District. We have a process right now for major UGB amendments in between the big, you know, every five-year UGB amendments. And that is open to any school district in the region. And while the bill would limit it to high-growth school districts there, it would most likely be designed to be available to any school district that that had such a need, that had to demonstrate the need there.
Okay. And do you think this will Will it facilitate Metro addressing the problem with high-growth districts not finding land for schools?
Well, I think so, Mr. Chair.
It's not as heavy-handed, I guess, as the original version.
That's right. It's much more acceptable to Metro, and we worked with Gary on developing this language, and Gary and I have had conversations throughout this process, this session, about the need for, immediately upon the passage of this bill, to start the conversations that really are going to make something happen. You know, we can do this, and then we need to talk and work together, and that's what we've what we're committing to do, not just waiting for the next crisis, but to kind of get going on it.
Okay. Other questions,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Berman.
Right now, I believe it's a conditional approval. You can get a school built outside the urban growth boundary under existing law. How would this differ from that process?
Well, my understanding, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, is that the only way to have a school built outside the urban growth boundary under existing law is the school is serving the rural community outside the urban growth boundary. If you're building a school to serve the urban community, you have to have it inside the urban growth boundary, or you have to expand the urban growth boundary. And so what this does, what this bill does, is it facilitates the process of expanding the urban growth boundary for a school district that can, that has that need. And applies for expansion.
I wasn't aware that the school conditional use outside their UGB was limited to rural populations.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, you might know more than I do about that, but that's my understanding. So I'd have to get somebody, you know, one of our lawyers, to answer your question probably. But I don't know of any cases of schools to serve urban populations, populations that live inside the urban growth boundary, being located outside the urban growth boundary. I know that in the last major urban growth boundary expansion that Metro did for residential use, the council also brought in a property in the Beaverton School District for school use. I know there is a case of a school that was located outside the urban I don't know the specifics of this case, but it's Barlow High School is located way outside, but I think that predates the urban growth boundary or something. And there are all kinds of problems associated with that. The sewage has to be trucked away from that school and all kinds of things. And so my understanding is that if you're serving an urban population, it has to be in the UGB or you have to move the UGB.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, I'll follow up on that.
Anything else from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Do you have a motion for the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1032.
Senator Burdick has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1032. Are there any objections? Or is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Do we have a motion for the bill?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1032 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 1032 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, could you call the roll? Senator Beyer, we're moving 1032. We've adopted the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
And so we're voting on the bill itself.
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Chair Rigo?
Aye. And bill passes, and I will carry that bill. Let's see here. 25, 7, 7. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2755. Committee staff, could you just remind us what the details are on this bill? This is the surveyor's bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2755 makes a number of technical changes to the
was specifying survey requirements related to subdividing new property. It redefines utility easements to take into account cable TV and other telecommunication services. It allows cities to contract with private surveyors instead of using a county surveyor who's an employee. There are two amendments that we have floating around. The dash four amendments. The dash four amendments address what was presumably a drafting error when the bill was drafted. And if I could find my copy of amendments, I could explain them.
It also is
yeah, that's the dash four. The dash four amendments, there was a minor error that implied that if streets had not been named at the time the plat was done, they didn't need to be shown on the plat, which is not what we want. So the amendments changed that to require that each street must be named and shown on the plat. And then, yes, the dash five amendments are conflict amendments, which address conflict with House Bill 2356.
The dash five amendments also include the dash four amendments?
Mr. Chairman, no, I believe we would need to pass them both.
Tom, do you want to come up and give us a reminder, please?
There we go.
Oh, I see. There's the dash four. That's right. That's right.
Go ahead.
We need the dash four and the dash five.
Represent the surveyors. We need the dash four and the dash five.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
As long as we've...
Okay. Can I have an amendment or a motion on those amendments, please?
In work session.
Yes, we are in work session.
Move the dash four.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash four amendments to House Bill 2755. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? So ordered.
Move the dash five amendments.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash five amendments to House Bill 2755. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
And move the bill as amended to the floor.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2755 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. Senator Atkinson, you want to carry that? Okay, Senator Atkinson will carry that. Linda Ludwig, I know you're still here. I just want to let you know we're not going to be moving House Bill 2722 today, if that's why you're hanging around. You don't have to leave, but I thought I'd let you know that.
The only things we haven't done is, well, this if you want to do it, and there's this puzzle cleanup thing, okay. Which I can explain.
Is he here?
No, he's not. I can get him or I can talk.
Well, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2258. Matt, if you could describe this bill for us, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2258 was actually brought to us by the Legislative Council Committee. It is a statutory cleanup bill that, unless I am greatly mistaken, makes no substantive changes to the law at all. It changes a number of musts to shalls. It's I'm looking at the wrong bill. And here we are. It rewords the violation section relating to unlawful trade practices just to make it read a little bit more clearly, but doesn't change any of the actual penalties. There's a couple of no actions shall to and action may not changes made, and that's about it. I spoke with Legislative Council for quite a while last week about it, and they assured me there's nothing in here that actually changes the law. This is an experiment they're trying this session to actually introduce bills to clean up the statute, which they haven't done, and which they have some reservations about doing in the future. But this session, we do have this one.
I'm open for suggestions from the committee. Do you want to hear from Legislative Council on this? Do you want to just move it? Do you want to think on it and move it on Thursday? I'm getting a big shrug of the shoulders.
Let's move it.
Okay, I think we want to move it then. Let's close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2258. Is there a motion?
Move the bill to the floor.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2258 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. Senator Byard, do you want to carry that bill? Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay. And then the last thing on our list
on
is 2577.
I'll just vote no on it.
Let's open a hearing for a possible reconsideration and work session on 2577.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2577. This was the bill we passed last week that required the Department of Ag and the State Weed Board to create a plan for the control of noxious weeds. There was an amendment brought to my office by Representative Krupp, but unfortunately we didn't get the amendment in time to pass it last week. And all the amendment does is change the requirement that the department seek the maximum amount of federal funding to a requirement that the department seek an optimal level of funding. Other than that, the amendment makes no changes.
And that's an amendment suggested by Representative Krupp.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right. And I believe we can suspend the rules and
make a motion to suspend the rules.
And repass the bill with those amendments. Are we amenable to this committee? Okay. The chair moves that we suspend the rules and
reconsider
the motion by which we passed House Bill 2577 last week. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
So now you're in work session.
Now we're in work session on House 2577. The chair moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2577. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. Chair moves House Bill 2577 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. And who was carrying it last time?
I think you were.
I was. Okay. Well, I will carry it this time. The obnoxious weed bill. And I believe that concludes our agenda. Is there anybody in the audience that is here for a bill that we haven't covered? Yes. And before we adjourn, we're going to reiterate what we're carrying over to next session.
Mr. Chairman, the list I had was Senate Bill 1061, House Bill 2729, Senate Bill 527, House Bill 2722, House Bill 2875, House Bill 3310, and House Bill 3349. All of those would be for work session.
Okay. The bills that were just mentioned will be carried over to our next regularly scheduled session. And the committee is adjourned.
Okay, yeah. 21, 27, 28, 5, 27.